Kyle Rittenhouse says his acquittal is a victory for the Second Amendment and self-defense. He gave his first interview since being found not guilty in the shooting deaths of two men during the Kenosha protests and riots last year that happened after the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Rittenhouse was facing five charges altogether. The jury acquitted him of all of them last week. He talked to Fox News' Tucker Carlson about what happened the night of the shootings, the lead up to the trial, and its conclusion.
It wasn't Kyle Rittenhouse on trial in Wisconsin. It was the right to self-defense on trial. Right. And if I was convicted, no one would ever be privileged to defend their life against attackers. And thank God they came to the correct verdict of a not guilty.
Many on the left, for example, say if Rittenhouse had been a person of color, the verdict, the outcome would have been different. Some legal experts have been urging people to not read too much into the verdict, saying that it only applied to this specific case and wasn't a referendum on broader issues. But our next guest says our response to the trial means a lot for the future of self-defense laws and for the value of human life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Rittenhouse verdict? Should we read it narrowly as just a verdict in this case, or does it mean something? Does it mean something wider than just what happened in that courtroom? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ian Main is an assistant professor of law at UW-Madison. He teaches civil procedure, civil rights, and wrongful convictions. He wrote a piece on the trial for NBC News. Ian, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it's good to be here. Thank you.
How do you interpret the verdict? Is it just about the Rittenhouse case, or does it go farther than that?
Of course, it's both. I mean, obviously, from defendant's point of view, it's very meaningful. And from the victims in this case, it's very meaningful. And then it's also meaningful to the nation. Lots of cases in our history have had cultural significance that have lasting reverberations as to where we are in society, what the community standard is, and how much we value life, and how we expect encounters to go between people. And so that was all in the debate, and obviously in the public debate. We saw that in the social media. There's a very vigorous discussion on both sides of the equation in terms of those who are obviously wanted to see Mr. Rittenhouse be prosecuted and convicted and those who wanted to see him go free.
In that piece I mentioned, you talked about that idea of a community standard when it comes to arguments of self-defense. And you point out there's a legal standard, but when you've got a bunch of people in a jury, they are interpreting that legal standard based on community values. So you think it is very worthwhile to look at the wider implications. Can you talk a little more about that?
I don't think, my guess is that the divisions that we see in Kenosha and then in Wisconsin and then in the nation regarding Mr. Rittenhouse's trial and our approach to what we view valid self-defense to be was also reflected in the jury room. I imagine the jury was somewhat reflective, had some representation of reflecting these divisions. So the jury is us. We are the jury. I think in terms of this particular statute, there's not a whole lot of guidance for a jury. The jury is asked to determine whether or not Mr. Rittenhouse's actions were reasonable and whether his fear of great bodily harm or imminent threat of death was reasonable. And, you know, I think they probably took his age into consideration, and there hasn't been a whole lot of discussion of his age. I personally think that we should not have been prosecuting him as an adult. I think that he should have been prosecuted as a juvenile, or at least processed as a juvenile. And so for me, I was caught between two aspects. One, my deep concerns about how we approach juveniles in the criminal justice system. And then the other one is how we define self-defense, just generally for all adults, regardless of age, once you age into being an adult.
You also wrote about one outside expert brought in early in the prosecution process here, talking about self-defense claims for someone who has a firearm, being able to raise the concern that someone else might take that firearm and then use it against them or others. So that by showing up with a firearm, in effect, you may be raising your right to make a self-defense claim even more?
Yeah, I think that's apparent from the verdict. I think it was an extraordinary moment, but one that I think is deeply ingrained in the narrative of those who believe that they have a right to self-defense by carrying openly firearms in society, regardless of the situation around them. And so, yeah, I think that there is a big issue here. The expert actually said, under questioning by the prosecutor, if Mr. Rittenhouse had not been armed and was approached in the exact same way by Mr. Rosenbaum, that first incident in which this man who was suffering from mental illness threw a plastic bag and obviously aggressed, he definitely aggressed on Mr. Rittenhouse, would it have been reasonable for example, Mr. Rittenhouse at that point to use deadly force, either, let's say, through a chokehold? And the expert said no. And I thought that's an extraordinary moment. In other words, if Mr. Rittenhouse had been unarmed, from the point of view of this use of force expert, he would not have been privileged. But since he had a firearm, he was privileged to use deadly force despite facing the exact same quote-unquote threat from Mr. Rosenbaum.
It's Brianna Caller now at 800-642-1234. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Yordis, hello.
Hello. He created the danger, Rittenhouse did. He's walking down the street with a long gun. He's a kid. And what I find shocking and frightening is that people that have a legitimate reason to protest the shocking shooting of that young man, now it's gone from being able to shoot black men on the street to shooting people that stand up to protest the abuse. And it seems like that's all right in this country. If you're black or you're someone that defends people that are black, you can now be shot with no consequences. It's horrifying to me.
Jordis, thanks for the call. Ian, what do you think?
Yeah, those concerns resonate with me in lots of different ways. I mean, you know, I really resonate with those comments. But, you know, the law in Wisconsin, which was really surprising, that it doesn't permit minors like Mr. Rittenhouse at 17 years old to walk around with dangerous weapons. But if you look deeply into Wisconsin law, and this is not to push back against the caller at all, it was just who we are. I'm talking about who we are as however terrifying that might be, what is our identity? That our law right now permitted Mr. Rittenhouse to walk around at 17 years old with a long rifle, more than 26 inches in length. So he was actually permitted to do what he did. Now, of course, it's not a good idea. Anyone with maturity or empathy or any kind of racial sensitivity would not, being certainly a white young male with military garb and a gun, go into a protest regarding a previous shooting of a black male by a white cop. That's so harmful to do to a grieving community anyway. And so that aside, which I found more than troubling, that we have laws that actually permit Mr. Rittenhouse to walk around with that long gun. I was still surprised that, you know, Mr. Rittenhouse was not even detained, and maybe I wasn't too surprised, but again, troubled that Mr. Rittenhouse was not at least detained by an officer that night just because he looked so young to be carrying a gun and to check ID. And that didn't even happen. And in some respect, that really reflects where we are as a society, that we have police who are, I guess, are accustomed or so accustomed to the idea that a young man like Mr. Rittenhouse has a right to carry an AR-15 around at night during protests is extraordinary to me.
Before we go back to our callers, I want to ask about the Ahmaud Arbery case in Georgia. Again, claims of self-defense being made by the defense team there after Mr. Arbery was pursued. The suspects pushed him off the road basically with their truck, leveled guns after him. When he tries to defend himself, they shoot him, and there's a claim of self-defense being made. We don't know yet. Of course, the jury just started deliberating today. Do you have thoughts on that case?
I do. I mean, there's some underlying similarities between that case and the Rittenhouse case in terms of the idea that for the defense, they're trying to argue that somehow that this was protection of the community against someone who's doing harm to the community. So in Mr. Rittenhouse's case, it was against arsonists and rioters and those who would burn things down and create, you know, harm to others through rioting, I guess. And then, you know, in the Mr. Arbery case, it involves three individuals who are claiming to protect the community from some kind of burglary. In fact, the defense counsel used extraordinary language, the word plunder to describe what Mr. Arbery was doing. There are some differences as well. Mr. Rittenhouse, at least as to the first incident, was aggressed upon. I would not characterize the second incident involving these three other individuals as aggressing upon Mr. Rittenhouse at all. But when you look at the Mr. Arbery case, oh my gosh, I mean, he was pursued. Mm-hmm. He was pursued. He was terrorized by multiple people in trucks with guns. I can't believe the kind of fear he must have been going through. That was just absolutely pure aggression and violence and, you know, the racial kind of aspect to it, and it being in the South, really reminiscent of vigilantes taking their matters into their own hands and just basically using their race privilege to kill a black man. It was really, really different in that particular respect.
We're talking about the verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, what it means for claims of self-defense and other issues. Ian Main stays with us, assistant professor of law at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a wider meaning, a wider lesson in the outcome of this trial, one you like or one you don't like? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking another look at the acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse. A lot of legal experts urge people not to read too much into the verdict, saying it only applied to Rittenhouse's specific case. Others seeing wider lessons in the verdict. Ian Main stays with us, assistant professor of law at UW-Madison, where he teaches civil procedure, civil rights, and wrongful convictions. Let's go back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Chippewa Falls. Bob, hi.
Hi. Hey, I think your guest makes a number of valid observations that go beyond the case. But to me, I think Rittenhouse now typifies the warped thinking of people who believe if they have a powerful firearm that they're invincible. He goes to this mass meeting or protest and probably suddenly realizes Wisconsin has concealed carry, and then fear takes over. And then the firearms just accelerate the damage. I frankly think he was afraid. And I don't know how he'll ever get away from the fact that two people died because of his warped thinking.
Bob, thanks for the call. What do you think of that, Ian, and the idea of the presence of firearms in this case accelerating, our caller says, the danger?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything Bob said. I think it was a really rich comment. And I agree with those observations. I do think that it does accelerate and escalate the violence that was used. And again, I think because he had a firearm in the way that we are understanding self-defense these days, that he had more discretion to use deadly force against those he felt in fear of than he would have if he had been unarmed. And we can debate back and forth. I mean, I certainly would think that he would not have been aggressed upon if he hadn't had a weapon. So there's also that aspect of escalation, that the presence of weapons absolutely raise tensions and increase the possibility for violence. And so to not take responsibility for you carrying you exercising your Second Amendment right as if it doesn't have any cost to society, I think is highly irresponsible. I think if you're going to believe that you have a right to do something, you should be really aware of the cost that it does have, not only to others, but possibly to yourself. And as to yourself, I think that Bob is right. As to Mr. Rittenhouse, I mean, he's being kind of, he's a young kid still, and he's being propped up by adults. But at a certain point, he's going to be, you know, by himself. And for a long time, will be, have to face these things that he did. And that is a huge amount of trauma and a huge weight. And it's not going to go away. And so, you know, to take these things and these narratives like self-defense and I have the right to carry and things like that is really, in the end of the day, really has a lack of empathy and maturity and vision about what really is going on. We are humans. We interact. We're very affected by someone who's next to us carrying a weapon. And it changes the way we interact with each other. And I really, it's unfortunate that that's the direction that we're going in our society.
Thanks for the call, Bob. We'll go now to Andy in Madison. Andy, hi.
Hi. I was kind of struck by what your guest said about saying that the law does allow him to carry a weapon because it wasn't a shortened one. The law is pretty clear that they can only carry the weapon in a hunting situation. And the judge basically pretended not to understand what the word or meant. So does your guest agree that the statute was vaguely written, or is he saying that because the judge ruled this way, that's now the way of law?
Interesting. John, Ian, was this a, I guess, a twisted rendering, a reading of the law, or is it just a gap in the law?
Yeah, again, I agree with John as well. I think that this particular law did have some failure in its drafting, and it wasn't clear, and obviously the defense capitalized on that. And, you know, regardless of how we view this judge, I mean, all judges have bias one way or the other, but this judge in this particular situation took very seriously the judicial canon that we strictly construe criminal statutes. The prosecution made a very strong argument that we need to read statutes in a way that that make sense of the statute and don't create exceptions that would swallow the rule, as this particular exception under C3 would. I understand the language and the debate over that or, but I wouldn't say that it's completely outside the, you know, a reasonable interpretation that the judge took. I don't agree with it, but I understand, you know, if I was on the prosecution, I'd be happy to argue why it only relates to hunting issues. But one could read the statute in another way, and that's how the judge read it. And it was a drafting error or not by the state legislature. I don't know.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Ian Main, assistant professor of law at UW-Madison, looking at possible wider outcomes, meanings of the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict late last week. Back to your calls now. Nadine is with us in Milwaukee. Nadine, hi.
Hi. I have three issues. First of all, now that he is found innocent, he could conceivably go to the police academy and become a police officer. And while most of our police officers are wonderful, we don't need another one who thinks that they have a license to kill. Second, I didn't hear any remorse or any accepting of responsibility in his voice. And I'm concerned that he does think he has a license to kill now and will go out and do this sort of thing again. And thirdly, I'd like to see this judge recalled.
Nadine, thanks for the call. We can only speculate about Kyle Rittenhouse's future or his, I guess, psychological state. Ian, your thoughts on the judge, people who, especially those who disagreed with the verdict, very critical of the judge's handling of the trial.
I understand that. And, you know, there was a media presence here and cameras going the whole time. Certainly what I saw as a criminal law litigator who's practice in all over the state of Wisconsin and also in high level cases like homicides. You know, there's a wide range of judging styles. I will say that I've certainly had my day where I've been on the receiving end of a judge's ire. I understand that, there was, you know, reasonable allegations of bias by this judge as to this case. There were some decisions that went well for the prosecutor, and there were some decisions that went well for the defense here. In terms of kind of the bell curve, I understand people's anger regarding this judge. I've certainly felt internally angry about the way I've been treated in the courtroom by a judge. I've certainly been screamed at. I've been screamed at in open court. I've been screamed at in chambers. I felt bad for the prosecutor for being yelled at on national TV, but the interaction itself seemed well within the bell curve. Given my experience, this is not to say this behavior is appropriate. All I'm saying is that this behavior is not outside the bell curve.
Thanks for the call. In just our last minute, Ian, do you think we need to revisit things like our self-defense laws in this country?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there needs to be clear guardrails about what force can be used. I think that we should not privilege those who have firearms any more than if they had been unarmed. So I think self-defense laws should assume that the person would have been unarmed, and that as an unarmed person, would they really have thought there was going to be a deadly threat? So it would be imagining Mr. Rittenhouse again without having the AR-15. Would he have been privileged to use deadly force? If he had not, then in my thinking, he should not be privileged. I don't think a gun should give you additional discretion to use violence against other civilians.
Ian, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Ian Main is an assistant professor of law at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about the acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse on murder charges and what it means for larger societal and policy questions, especially related to claims of self-defense.